We have the tech to get food delivered in 15 minutes, but we all have horror stories about buying tickets. The Game Time app gives fans the advantage. Get amazing tickets in just a few taps. Fees are included, so what you see is what you pay. And the Game Time guarantee means authentic tickets at the best price every time. Take the guesswork out of buying tickets to concerts, sports, comedy, and more with Game Time. Download the Game Time app and create an account for $20 off your first purchase. Terms apply.
And now it's time for the Sports Kings from Queens.
It looks like Berhalter is the one who's...
Richards beaten out of the air. Freeze has got to get there and deal with it. He takes it down off the chest. Cantillara knocks it away. Tim Ream can't block it. And unless video review says this is a foul from behind on Ream, it is a disastrous third goal to concede to Belgium.
From the heart of Queens to the ears of sports fans everywhere, this is a Sports Kings from Queens. Strap in because the Kings are in session. Today is Wednesday, July 8th. This is episode 243. I'm Gino, joined by my co-hosts, Kevin and Darren. Please catch Swivvy at your podcast. Like, subscribe, follow us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. Give us a like, join our pages. We'd love to hear from you. Feel free to drop us a comment, a question. We'll get back to you. Tonight, we go around the world of sports. Right now, the sports world is all about the World Cup. Unfortunately, U.S. exited Monday night. Kev, let's talk about the U.S.
Yeah, it's really a shame because they came off that round of 32 game against Bosnia. I mean, that was – I mean, they've had a couple of really great games leading up to during the group stage. But that
they
one,
did.
That one, you know, Balogun scores right before the half. Then he gets sent off for that controversial red, which we can talk about in a minute, 64th minute. So they're playing for the last half hour of the game down a man. Tillman – knocks in that beautiful free kick in the 82nd minute.
Hold I'm going to ask you guys a quick question before you jump from. Yep. Tillman's kick was amazing, and he had another one in the next game.
Yep.
I would have never guessed that Tillman was going to be the guy to take those free kicks. I would have thought it would have been Pulisic, or it would have been Weston McKinney. I had no clue that Tillman was that guy.
Neither did I.
I thought I watched enough games to know, Kev. I was stunned by it. Anyway, I digress. Go back to you. Sorry.
Yeah, so, you know, great win against Bosnia, and, you know, the controversy after that was Maligan's got to miss the next game because of the red card. First off, that was not a deserved red card. We watch every 4 years, I know. We're not the hugest of soccer fans, but you got two guys going up, coming back down in basically the same space, and because the Bosnian defenders – went down, foot basically landed first. The Balogun came down on top of him. He gets the red card for that. That was atrocious. The fact that there's no foul in the play until they went to VAR, really, really bad. Darren.
Yeah, I mean, there's got to be something with intent. A late slide with spikes up, yes. Even if you're not trying to hurt the guy, you were late, but it's still intent. This is an accidental thing with two guys jumping at the same time, one guy landing first, the other one landing on his ankle. Listen, it's a painful play, all that stuff, but in a sport that lives and dies with diving, this was not one of those things that deserved to be a red card. And it becomes a very controversial thing the rest of the way, Kev, but there was no way. And I didn't hear one announcer that thought it was a red card that was neutral in any language. So it was kind of a crappy call.
Yeah,
I didn't think it was a red card either, but – you know, part of the problem is I don't think we know what a red card is. There's no definition of what it should be. You know, for us, it's always intent seems to be our definition.
Well, that's in the definition of the rule, by the way. Intent, intentional. Intent is part of the definition.
Yeah.
Well, you know, then someone needs to inform the refs that, because it never seems like that is what they're going by.
Gino, we've been watching football for 40 years. We don't know what a catch is, right?
Yeah,
I mean, I'm just saying. So
I know
it depends on the arbitrary ruling of the official at the time. But as Kev pointed out, this put the U.S. down a man for a long time.
And they did a great job down the man.
They
didn't sit back. They did try to play some pressure. And that got them the free kick for Tillman, which made it 2-0, which finally gave them the breathing room. It's not like they sat back in a shell for the last half hour and said and played scared defense. They played their offense for the most part. They were trying to press as much as you want to down a man.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, after the fact, you know, Sunday the decision comes down. The FIFA is going to basically suspend his suspension for a year. He's on probation for the next year. If nothing happens, he could probably not have to serve the suspension at all. Questions if Trump had any sort of influence on FIFA's president to get this done. And Belgium's up in arms, which I think rightfully so. I mean,
they weren't preparing for Balogun. They were preparing for Pepe. And let's be honest, he's not the same player.
With the chain of events, the game was Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
If FIFA comes down Thursday after reviewing it and saying that was a BS call, he didn't deserve the red card. There's no suspension. That's a different story than doing it the day before the game. And I think Belgium would have had less to complain about. But I think going into it, Belgium, I mean, the game they played before the U.S. in the round of 32, I mean, this is not the strongest Belgian team. I mean, they needed two goals in 3 minutes in the 80-something minute to get the tie. And then the penalty kick in the 125th minute, again on a VAR review, giving them the penalty to beat Senegal. I think Belgium came in. They were, I think, pissed off that Balogun was playing. And they came out with something to stick it to the U.S. U.S. looked unprepared. They looked scared. And I think the difference in class showed up in this one. The early goal, the ninth minute, the Ketelaere, I think is pretty close to how you pronounce it, puts it in. I mean, balls up there, three defenders around it, and nobody goes for it. That was just poor defense overall. That was poor team defense there. Right, Darren?
Oh, I thought the entire night was a defensive struggle for this team.
And then the 33rd minute, he scores again on the header, just beat Ream.
He wanted it more than Tim Ream did. Ream just simply got overrun. He's supposed to be the captain. Yeah. That wasn't a very captain-like move right there. It was about as disappointing a goal a minute and change after the U.S. tied it up that you could possibly have. The momentum, the crowd, probably the best crowd that the U.S. is going to get. You're in Seattle, okay? This is going to be where the crowd is the craziest and most frenziest of all. You know, the other markets, Columbus, which didn't have a game, and Kansas City, these are known as the three biggest U.S. crowds on a regular basis when they're playing international friendly stuff like that. And when you can't live off that crowd for more than a minute, come on, bad job by the U.S. particularly Ream there, and all night, Kev, it was just tough. I'll let you finish your point, but then I'll chime in after. But it just looked disappointing.
You know, like you said, Tubman puts in the free kick. If you go into the locker room 1-1 despite being outplayed and you got the crowd behind you, you come out the second half, it's a far different feeling than being down 2-1 when you give up the goal like that in a minute and a half. It was just so deflating. And you just felt like, you know, Belgium said, all right, here's your one. We'll get back on top, and we're going to just keep outclassing you the rest of the game. And then the second half comes along, 57th minute. Freeze tries to come out and play the ball outside his box at the top there. And on the clearing attempt, he
stubbed. He didn't even try to kick it. He didn't even move his foot.
Well, he went for the kick, and like the kick is his toe stuck behind him, and
it's almost like he hesitated, didn't know to kick it. The thing is, it was a smart play to come out because it would have been a one-on-one. He had to come out and make the play, but you got to clear it right away.
His experience, which
we talked about leading into this tournament, showed in that very moment. He made some nice saves early. He really did. He kept them in early. I'm not going to kill Freeze all the way, but then you saw that moment, and you were like, "This is what we talked about." He doesn't have the experience in international play. Maybe he gets better, but that was unimpressive, to say the very least.
The word I'll use is indecisive. He came out. He was very indecisive on how he wanted to play that ball, and it showed way too much, and it wound up costing them.
Yep. And then let's face it, the Belgian team really didn't let the U.S. even have chances. the rest of the game. It's not like, oh, we're down 3-1. We've got to create chances. The U.S. didn't create much at all, despite, you know, in theory, having to press, having to try to get two goals back, and there was just nothing offensively going.
Well, they had possession. They had a decent amount of possession in this game. Here's what we found out. The midfield was mostly invisible. They couldn't make any plays. They couldn't force it in. Balogun, by the way, was the only guy I thought that played really well the entire game. He was up there by himself. Balogun tried to make chances happen. He was the only one making runs. He was the only one doing anything. McKennie was disappointed. And Pulisic getting killed, by the way, by everybody. And I know he got hurt, but you know what? I mean, it was Landon Donovan's comment. You would have had to drag me out of that game. Tim Howard saying you're the leader. You're supposed to be the guy. You're supposed to be the best player in American history, and you go out like that. But even before he got hurt, he couldn't control a dribble. Almost every U.S. player, every first touch was strong. They could not get control of the ball. Inaccurate passing all over the place. Their possession was just the three defensemen kicking it around to each other. They pulled Dest, who's kind of a playmaker, a little early, I thought. Nothing against Reyna going in, but Reyna showed nothing in the second half either. They could not find cracks, Gino. They were sitting there passing around the top, maybe going wide every now and again to Anthony Robinson, but they found no cracks in the middle where they could get real shots. And that's with them pressing. It was unimpressive, to say the very least. I was stunned by it.
So, I don't think the U.S. played their best game. I think the talent disparity really showed. And I think this is where you see that the U.S. is probably a team that is still in the teens overall in the world. Whether you call them the 12th ranked team or the 15th ranked team, they're not a top 10 team. They're not going to play like a top 10 team. And when you play a team that is better than you, this is what happens. And for them to beat a team that is better than them, they have to come out and play well. And when you don't play well, this is what it looks like.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you a little bit, because Senegal is not a higher ranked team than the United States. Senegal had Belgium beaten. And Belgium struggled all the way throughout this tournament.
But I'm talking about the U.S.
in this tournament. They didn't score anything but an own goal through the first two games. But the fact of the matter is that I think they, like Kev said in the beginning, they came out hungry. And I think the U.S. came out tentative and scared. The word indecisive about Freeze could probably be said about all of them. That first goal, that ball bounces in between three defensemen. They let Belgium get it and score. Gino, your word indecisive is probably the cleanest word of the entire night for the entire team. Seemed like nobody knew what they wanted to do. I know we're talking about Freeze, but I thought you have it right for everybody. It was just like you said, Gino, they have to play really, really well to play against a team of that level, and they did not.
Yeah, what it shows is when you see them making those first passes and not being able to get those second passes off. And that's where it shows. And it showed a lot in that game.
Dribble like what, five times before he got hurt? I mean, he was getting stripped clean. He's supposed to be the guy that plays in Europe.
Yeah.
McKennie's supposed to be the guy that plays in Europe. These guys aren't supposed to lose possession to you know, a very good Belgian team, but this isn't like the Renaissance Belgian team. These guys are old now. De Bruyne didn't even get in. Lukaku scored late because Chris Richards gave one away, but he only played 20 minutes. These were the guys that were supposed to lead Belgium to their high points, and they did in Europe, but they never made it in the World Cup that far. And they played without these great players for the golden team for them. And and they still won pretty easy. That goal over Ream killed me. I was so pissed. I was like, he just didn't want it. He got overrun. How the hell does that happen? Richard's giving it away late. I was already despondent. Freeze giving it away on the third goal. You're like, what the hell? You sit there and watch it, and every goal that Belgium scored was because the United States didn't want it as much as Belgium did. There was not one great play that Belgium made that it was, oh, my God. They were simply out-hustled, outworked, and they didn't have the want to. It killed me that they didn't really want to, because you're never going to play another World Cup on home field again. Okay, next, what is it, in 23rd? They start in Uruguay, Paraguay, and Argentina, and then they go to Portugal, Morocco, and Spain, I think, right? And then the year after that, Saudi Arabia. They're never, these guys are never going to be able to play back here again. None of these guys are going to be good enough to play when they're 40. No. I mean, even if the U.S. does get it after that again. This is your chance on U.S. soil, and you came out flat. You came out like you didn't give a damn. And it was so, oh, we were all so looking forward to it. That was it. This is the sport we have right now. We're sitting there saying, give us a chance to watch something. And I mean, you know, five guys that don't watch a ton of soccer are sitting there texting each other. That's our group, right? I mean, Kev watches probably more than I do because you watch EPL. Gino watches some Europe. I catch a little bit of Europe, but not as much as you two guys. But I was all gung-ho for this. And the starch take out of me right away. And then at the nine-minute mark, down 1-0, you're like, shoot. They'll get it together, but they never did.
Okay. The only final point I have is, though, is that this is kind of where I thought they would be. I thought they would be at this point with a chance to either win or lose. And this is the point where they were at, and they had a chance to win or lose, and they lost. I thought not getting to this point would be a complete disappointment. And I think winning this, and I thought, and this was before this started, and I thought winning this game would be a huge victory for them. So overall, my big thing is I'm not highly disappointed, and I'm not highly excited. This is kind of where I thought they would be. Did you think they would be better or worse than this point?
Kev?
I thought they had a chance to be better. And again, like you
how
said,
much better? How much better?
I'm gonna piggyback on what you said. Part of it is, you know, yes, this game was a win or lose game in the round of 16. They played Belgium. If they had played to the level they were playing early in the World Cup, and they go out there and they play a hard fought, lose 2-1, I'm okay with that. The fact that they pulled a no show and lost 4-1, I'm disappointed.
Yeah, I'm gonna agree exactly with Kevin. I thought they could get to the 8. I picked them to get to the 4, but let's be honest, I'm a homer. I thought they could get to the 8. I thought that this would be a tough matchup. If they gave Belgium a good game, I would have been much happier. Even if they would have lost 4-1, they lost on 2 late goals because they're pressing and they're doing everything right and they're making chances, but they're not getting shots on goal. A couple of big saves. They did nothing on offense. And that, so you have that bad taste in your mouth just because of the way they performed. It's okay. Not because of where they finished, though, G, because you're right.
Okay.
Finishing in the 16 is not something that we would have thought was wrong, but the way they finished in the 16 kind of pissed me off.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Listen, I can accept that. I just think this is kind of where I thought they would be.
Yeah, no,
you know, listen, I think if they had gotten anywhere past this, I would have been very excited. And if they were anywhere before this, I would have been completely disappointed. Had they lost the game before this, it would have been a complete disappointment.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I'm okay at this point. I wish they would have put in a better performance, like you guys said. But, you know, I'm kind of okay with this. You know, up until now, I think the rest of the World Cup has been very exciting. Kev?
Oh, yeah. Just one last question before we get into it. Pochettino, any questions on the coach? Any criticism that you'd have on Pochettino?
I want him back. I think he's going to get a club team here and get another job and won't be back. But I would take him in a heartbeat.
I thought he did a fine job. I can't blame him for the positions he put the guys in. I do think that they need to find someone else to play back there with Richards. I think Freeman's young enough to be that guy, the second guy, but we need someone to replace Ream, who's getting older and clearly just doesn't have the skill to play with these best players in the world. That's just my take. Outside of that, though, I have no issues with Pochettino. Gino, any issues with the coach before we move on to the rest?
No, listen, I think he's done a good job. He seems to bring the other players here. So, you know, that's good for the United States. They kind of find a way to, you know, you have two brothers on your mother's side, sisters, cousins, uncle. We need to get you here. So, okay, there you go.
Pretty much. Everything we complain about France, we think is great about the United States. But anyway, we move on.
Yeah, so Gino, you mentioned the rest of the World Cup's been great. I mean, when we're in our preview, we mentioned some of the big stars here, and you look at the Golden Boot race. Messi's got 8 goals, and Mbappe and Haaland are tied with 7, and Kane's got 6. Those are the guys you wanted to see. They're all on teams that are winning. They're teams that are in the final 8, and they are showing up and showing out in this World Cup.
Absolutely. I agree with you. So why don't we talk about the round of 8 here? Why don't we talk about the quarters?
Sure. I guess we'll go in order here. We'll start with France and Morocco. I think there's absolutely no surprise to see France here in the final 8. I mean, they're one of the definite favorites to advance and win the World Cup. They were able to beat Paraguay 1-0 thanks to an Mbappe penalty kick in the 70th minute. You know, that was a game that I felt like Paraguay sat back and was just playing for that 0-0 draw and go on penalty kicks. And France was patient enough, finally got the chance in the box, got the penalty call, and Mbappe buried it. And that sets them up to play Morocco. The other big thing is, you know, Dembele's got 4 goals as well. Olise's been setting them up too. 5 assists leads the World Cup. So it's not just the Kylian Mbappe show. They've got the playmaker in Olise. They've got other goal scorers. And they are, at least what I've seen so far, the best team in the World Cup. And they're going against Morocco.
No doubt about that, Kev. I agree with you. I mean, this is not a team that you're surprised. The chippiness of Paraguay, probably the dirtiest team in the tournament, or one of them anyway, according to France, according to the way they play.
Even over Mexico?
That's what Paraguay has to kind of do to be competitive. Doesn't make it right. I'm just saying that's what they have to make the game ugly, and that's what they do. You go to the other side. This is a rematch of the semifinal from 4 years ago. Morocco surprised everybody. The Atlas Lions, as Gino likes to know the team's nickname, so I throw them out there. This is a team that's good, but they're a little bit more structured and defensive. Okay, they can put the ball in the net. They beat Canada 3-0. All of the hosts lost in that round, and we'll get to the Mexico game in a little bit. But this team, they're led by Hakimi. He's the captain. He's the leader. He's the attacking guy. They have Yacine Bounou. He's a great goalie. He hasn't been beaten much at all. And then Diaz is a creative spark. So they got a bunch of guys. What's going to come down to is, can Hakimi check Mbappe, right? Can he offset or at least slow him down? That's the matchup. In this whole thing, we have a defensive team against the most elite offensive team we've seen in this entire tournament. And I don't think it's even close. I mean, and we're talking about Argentina's been great offensively. We talk about Norway's been great offensively. We're talking about England's been great offensively. And yet France looks like they're playing chess against everybody else's checkers, what they're doing right now. So it's going to come down to Morocco trying to keep the game defensive, slower, try to get into kicks somehow, try to keep it 1-1. You know, if it gets the 2 goals from France, I think it's over. I think Morocco needs to keep it in that 1 goal space, but it should be a great matchup. Again, Morocco, the only team left in Africa, no team left in North America, only one in South America. Everybody else is from Europe. So, it's 6 European teams, an African team, and this is them. And they have a lot of confidence. I think Morocco is going to give them a game. G?
See, and I think the opposite way. I think Morocco, I think they want chaos. I think they want to play wild. They want emotional. They want momentum-driven stuff. They're going to try to shock everybody. They're going to try to throw everybody into the craziness. They want fireworks. They want Mbappe to be freaking losing his mind out there, and that's how they try to pull the upset. I think if they try to play this game steady 2-1, they lose. I think the only way for them to win is to just play chaos.
They have to play a completely different style than they play. They're not an aggressive offense. They score. They're an efficient offensive team, but they're not an aggressive offensive team.
I'm telling
you.
They
rely on a great goalie. That's what they rely on. That's what they play solid defense. They counterattack whenever they can. I hope you're right, because we want to see a great game, and we don't want to see one that's 0-0. We want to see something that happens. So I agree with you.
Well, listen, I don't know if they're going to be able to score like that on France, but I think if you're asking me what they're going to try to do, I think that's what they're going to try to do.
I think it's going to be the other way. I think that they're going to try to control. They're not going to have possession. They'll be lucky if they get 40% of the possession. They're going to have to take chances when they do it. But what they have to do is they're going to have, you know, 9 guys behind the ball at all times, 10 guys behind the ball at all times. That's just what they're going to do. Because France is they want to slow Mbappe and the team down. If they get into a foot race against them, nobody's beating France in a foot race. Nobody. Argentina's not beating France in a foot race. And they're as close as you can come. But I get your point, Gino. They have to find a strategy because they're not going to win this game by just doing nothing.
I agree. That I agree with.
And they're going to counter well.
That I agree with.
So, prediction in this game, boys. Who wins it? Kev?
France 2-0.
Gino?
France 3-1.
I'm going to say France 1-1 penalty kicks.
Ooh.
I think this one's going to kicks. I think Morocco's mad they lost in the semi last time. I think they're going to bounce back. We'll find out. But we all have France advancing, and because we really go out on limbs here on the Sports Kings from Queens. Gino, what's the next matchup we got, pal?
Next one up is Spain and Belgium. So Spain comes off the gritty 1-0 win over Portugal. Classic Spain in that one. Possession, patience. Midfield that treats the ball like it's a family heirloom. They've allowed just one goal in knockout play. They're going to try to smother Belgium with tempo and control. But Belgium, man, they're flying. They just dropped 4 on the United States. We just talked about it. Looks like the attack finally woke up. But is it chaos? Is it because they played the U.S.? They're going to want transition. They're going to want to stretch Spain. They're going to make Spain feel uncomfortable. So I think this one's all about rhythm. Okay. If Spain dictates the pace, they're going to grind Belgium down. If Belgium turns this into a track meet, I think Spain's in trouble, right? You got two different styles out there. They both played well their last match, though. So you got Spain's midfield. You got Belgium's counterattack. I think that's a chess match you got to watch.
You know, it's funny. The Spain-Portugal matchup is like the U.S.-Mexico matchup. It's like that border war. Kevin points it out. He put it perfectly. The Iberian battle, the Iberian Peninsula. But it is. I mean, these are two countries that neighbor each other, that battle. And then you sit there and, you know, you have the Ronaldo factor on one side. The guy's 41 and still out there, whether you like him or you don't like him. The guy's 41 and still, you know, battling up front. And then you have Spain, who, just like Gino said, the control. So it's really exciting stuff. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
That's right. So for Spain on the midfield side, I think you'll have Pedri. He's going to run. Everything's going to run through him, his control, his passing tempo. And Gavi, he's the relentless presser. He connects. He breaks all everything up. That's where all the rhythm's going to come from. And I think for Belgium, what you're going to see is what you didn't see with the U.S. game. You're going to see De Bruyne out there. You're going to see Lukaku out there to start the game. I think that's how they're going to try to start this up. That's the counter match. That's how they're going to try to score a couple of goals, to put the transition weapon of Jeremy Doku out there. And maybe you'll see the goal scorer in the U.S. game, Charles Decatale, Kev. He scored the two goals. He scored the two goals versus the U.S.
Yeah,
maybe we see him come on in the second half. So I think that's what we'll see in that matchup. Spain plus 370 to win it all. Belgium at plus 3,000. So you see the way the odds makers think this is going to go. I think Belgium gives them a game. I think at the end it's probably Spain 2-1. What do you guys think?
Spain's defense has been terrific. And they do
absolutely amazing.
And when you look at the goal they scored in their last game, that, I mean, it was a beautiful pass, beautiful play to get through the middle there to put it away. I think they play such good team defense with enough offense, but you know, Belgium's playing with house money a little bit here, and you know, they've got some momentum after the big win. I see this one going maybe 2-2 and going to penalties, and Spain coming up on top in penalties.
You know, I'm going to be opposite of you guys. I'm going to take Belgium to win this one in a close one. And Yamal, to me, is the best player on the field. I'm not trying to take anything away from what Spain does. I'm going to go with the experience over the youth. This is a younger Spain team. This is a little bit more of a veteran. I'm going to go with what Gino said is what Belgium needs to do. I think that De Bruyne getting the extra rest. I think that Lukaku, is a beast when he gets a chance to do it. I think that he'll put a little bit more pressure. Don't get me wrong. Nothing against Cristiano Ronaldo, who's one of the greatest players of all time. Top five, probably. But he's 41 years old, and it's a little bit different with him up front rather than the guys with the huge size that Belgium can throw at you. I'm going to say Belgium wins this game 2-1, and I think it's going to be a really nip-and-tuck game. I think that I think Belgium finds a way. I don't know why. I just think that the comeback from Senegal and then the – adversity against the United States has this team kind of banded together a little bit, and Spain's coming off the emotional win against Portugal, so it could be a letdown. That's all I'm saying.
All right, next up we got Norway versus England. Kev
likes both of these teams, so this is going to be fun because Kev's a fan of both squads.
I love both coming in. Norway, they got here, they beat Brazil 2-1. This was scoreless until Erling Haaland put his stamp on the game. Goals in the 79th and 90th minute. They survived the Neymar PK, 10th minute of stoppage time. They win 2-1. I mean, that game, the goals, you know, the shots at goal, Brazil had 14. Norway had 9. The expected goals, Brazil's expected goals was 2.5. But an island came up huge for Norway time after time. And kept him in the game until Haaland did enough to give him the 2-1 win. England, on the other hand, man, just when you think you see the match of the tournament, at that point, though, the England-Mexico match may have been the match of the tournament. I mean, this was England going to a hostile environment in Mexico. They're playing at Azteca Stadium, which Mexico never loses there. And this was scoreless. Until Jude Bellingham, 36th and 38th minute, bang, bang, 2-0 before you knew it. And I thought the big thing was Quinones gets him back 2-1 before the halftime. And much like the U.S., you know, England gets an early red card. Kwanzaa gets red card in the 54th minute. So they've got to play 40 minutes down a man in Mexico. Kane got through. Darius, can I say something?
No, I'm just going to say, before those two goals, I thought Mexico was actually outplaying England pretty well in that game. Mexico got off to the better start. They couldn't put it in. England all of a sudden gets the first Bellingham goal. Then they get the second Bellingham. You're like, oh, my God. How are they down 2-0? And Mexico was doing everything right. Listen, I'm a U.S. fan. I'm not rooting for Mexico. I was happy. Don't get me wrong. But I was just like, wow, Mexico was doing everything right. And then he still couldn't. And they still were down 2-0 because of the size. The sheer size of England against Mexico was very obvious watching that match. Anyway, sorry, Kev.
Yep. So after the red card, you know, England still keeps on the press a little bit. They get free, get the penalty, and Kane takes the PK and scores it in the 60th minute to go up 3-1. About 10 minutes later, Kane gets called for the penalty in the box. So he not only kicks a penalty kick, but he also gives one up. And Jimenez puts it in to make it 3-2. And I think for the last 20 minutes, Mexico must have had chance after chance. I mean, they had 20 shots at goal compared to England's 6. They dominated the whole match, basically. They dominated when England was down to 10 men. They just couldn't find the equalizer.
The funny thing is, if the U.S. would have played somewhat like that, not because they were playing 11 on 10, it's a little different, so don't get me wrong, and lost the game to Belgium, I would have been okay. I would have been a little happier because at least my team's trying to do something. The U.S. didn't know what to do with themselves. Anyway, I digress.
No. So now that sets up Norway and England. I'm recording that game because I'm going to be out, and I want to watch it later. I mean, that's how much I'm into this game. You know, Norway, they like to push. They're suspect of giving up the counterattack. So I think, you know, the defense can be stretched a little bit. Haaland, though, my goodness, the guy doesn't need too many touches. But once he gets a chance, how many times does he put it away? I mean, it feels like almost every time he's got a chance, he puts it away.
His second goal between the defender's legs, and put in the perfect spot. I don't even know how you do it. You know, I mean, I'm just because he's a big bruising guy. He kicks it between the defender's legs, finds the corner. You're like, all right,
Holland's nothing you can do about that. England, you know, one of the pre-tournament favorites, but we know that they have had their issues with their previous World Cup teams. But this one, you know, we mentioned Kane. Bellingham's up to 4 goals also, so they've got the 2 goal scorers. They showed a lot, like I said, in Mexico. This is going to be an up-and-down match. I think both teams can score. I see both teams having generating great chances. I could see this one going 3-3 and going to penalty kicks. I mean, that's the type of goal scoring I expect to see in this game. What do you guys think?
Who wins it, though? You can't just leave it at penalty kicks.
Oh, sorry. Norway, 4-3 in penalties.
All right.
Norway wins it 4-3 in penalties.
All right, Gene.
I think England, somebody in England, I think Kane chokes.
Where you going, Gino? Who wins this one?
Norway, 3-1.
I'm going to take England to win 3-2. Not penalties. The only one I have in penalties is the other one right now. But I think that I don't know. I just think England's a little bit more complete. I like the depth they have. Defensively, I like the size that they have. I think that, honestly, watching Norway in the game against Brazil, Brazil was the more skilled team. They were a little faster. Norway seemed to be a little slower to the ball. Yeah. Just Brazil doesn't have the typical Brazil finishers that they've had in years past, and that's what kind of cost them, I think. Listen, I'll be honest. I'm rooting for Norway. I think that England finds a way to win this one, though. And then the final quarterfinal matchup. Two games to say, hold my beer. Argentina-Egypt. No one thought this was going to be a game, just like no one thought Cape Verde was going to give Argentina a game in the round before it, which might have been the game of the tournament because the entire world, except for Argentina, is rooting for Cape Verde at the time. And Cape Verde, the second smallest country in the tournament behind Curacao, you know, extra time, they lose 3-2. Kev, I know you are all over this game. Tell us a little bit about Argentina-Cape Verde real quick before I get into the next round.
Well, Messi scored in the first half, and, you know, just felt like it was a matter of time before Argentina puts the second one in and pulls away. And then before you know it, Duarte scores 59th minute. They go to extra time, tied 1-1, and that's when the goal-scoring barrage started. Argentina gets the early one, 92nd minute. Just 2 minutes into extra time, Martinez scores, and Cape Verde, you think they're done? No, 103rd minute, Lopez Cabral scores to tie it up again at 2. And just when you think you go into penalties, Argentina gets the corner. Messi sends it in. It was headed by Romero off the defender Borges. It's technically an own goal. I mean, to me, it's still a header in.
It was a great goal. Actually, I'm sorry. He did everything right, Gino.
It was a deflection of the defender.
Tell us how you feel about Messi. Go ahead, G.
Do you want to bring up the fact that they brought the ball all the way down and scored? And then it was called back.
Oh, that's the next game.
That's the next game against Egypt. That's the game against Egypt. But yeah.
Oh, my God.
I mean, so Argentina wins the most exciting game that we'd seen up to that point. There was a lot of great games, but that was up there with anything. Then they play Egypt. Then they fall behind 2-0 in this game. Get a little bit of questionable. 1-0 in the first half. Then in the 67 minutes, 2-0 Egypt. And all of a sudden, you're saying to yourself, okay, Argentina's going to have to do something. Kev?
I was going to say, before that's where Gino brought up, 58th minute.
Zico scores.
And here comes VAR review because all the way back into the end, 2 minutes before the goal was scored, we found a foul on the takeaway, basically, before the buildup, and took that away. But then Zico does score, like you said, in the 67th minute to make it 2-0.
And then all of a sudden, you know, it looks like, you know, Egypt's a pretty good, solid defensive team. Argentina controlled the ball. Argentina had 19 shots to 5, did everything you possibly could. And you're saying to yourself, Egypt's sitting back and they're doing everything fine. And all of a sudden, 79th minute, Argentina gets the first one, okay? They get Romero scores. Okay, it's 2-1. You're like, okay, now it's a game. Now all of a sudden you're expecting Argentina to come back. You're expecting this to go to, you know, to overtime. You really are. You're expecting no chance that Egypt hangs on. And Messi says 4 minutes later, you're right. I'm going to tie it up. 2-2.
Messi!
Gino, big fan of Lionel Messi. Been following him since he was a kid in grammar school. But so then you think, okay, Egypt, you know, they did everything that they could. We're probably going to go to extra time. But then in the 92nd minute, Enzo Fernandez, the other star on this team. Everybody's talking about Messi. Enzo Fernandez is a superstar. He puts the game winner in. Then all of a sudden, a couple of yellows for Egypt just to make sure nothing exciting is going to happen. You know, and it's pretty much over. I mean, Egypt had four yellow cards in the last 8 minutes. The officiating was very pro-Argentina, don't get me wrong. Argentina was also the better side in this matchup. But
yeah,
Argentina scores three goals in 13 minutes to just take away the snatch victory from the jaws of defeat and advance again, just like they did against Cape Verde. And then Switzerland.
Egypt was pissed off that, you know, they felt like there was a foul in the buildup, just like the goal, the foul against them that took away their goal.
It was. No doubt about it. It was the same thing. They could have called it both ways. They didn't.
Same exact play.
It was definitely questionable refereeing gets Argentina through. And then we go to Switzerland, Colombia.
But you're up to nothing. You're up to nothing with 11 minutes left. You got to finish that off.
Of course you got to finish that off. But Egypt escaped, you know, getting in. I mean, you know, Egypt had to do a lot just to qualify and get in. A lot of, the game with Iran and everything else that they had. They were not an explosive offensive team all the way through here. But, you know, they were up 2-0. No one expected it. This was the one game. If you would have told me this was the 4-1 game, I would have believed you. Instead, it was Belgium and the U.S. But, you know, and then you get the Swiss. The Swiss and Colombia. Now, this game is actually really good, except for the fact that Colombia can shoot a ton and can never get it on goal because they control this game. Possession-wise, not so much. Switzerland is going to play more of a style that's designed to kind of just sit back. You know, they're going to counter. That's the way they're going to play. And Colombia is aggressive and talented. A lot of good players. But they had a lot of the big plays down the stretch, late in regulation, a lot of big time plays in overtime, in the extra time, a lot of big things in the extra periods. They just couldn't put the ball in. And then we go to kicks. And, you know, second kick off the crossbar for Colombia. Switzerland's like, well, you know what? Freaking, I'm going to kick it 30 yards over the net for the third kick. It wasn't even close. I mean, the goalie didn't have to move.
No.
The third kick for Colombia, the goalie guesses right, and it goes under his arm. He should have had it.
Yeah.
And Gregor's been outstanding. Coble's been outstanding in this. And then he makes the huge save on the fourth kick, which was actually struck very hard. And very well, just a better save, a better guess. They win 4-3 on penalty kicks. Again, Switzerland not as talented as Colombia, but this is the way Switzerland plays. This is what Switzerland's designed to do. Switzerland's going to frustrate you. They're going to counter you. They have guys that can put the ball in the net. They have solid midfielders, and now we're going to get the matchup, Argentina versus Switzerland. When you look at this matchup, right, Argentina – it's going to be the attack against the defense, just like the other matchup we talked about before. I mean, Argentina's had given up 4 goals, though, in the last 2 games, which is not something you expect from the defending champ. The Swiss have been, you know, they haven't made this round since 1954. Gino remembers. He was there. 1954 when Switzerland last got to the quarters. So this is a big deal. This is going to come down to can Switzerland kind of bother Messi. Messi seems to move the least amount of yards for a guy that gets into the right spot every time. It's like watching Wayne Gretzky play hockey. I don't go where the puck is. I go where the puck's going to be. Messi's there. He finds his way. He's a magician with the ball. He can do a million things. These are all things that are bothering my friend Gino right now. But he's a magician with the damn ball, and he tries to do it. Can Switzerland limit the influence of Messi on this game? Are they going to be able to do it and get some counterattacks? Because Messi's not going to chase him back up the field, let's be honest. Coble has been maybe the best goalie in the entire tournament. If not, he's up there, top three. He's going to have to stand on his head to win this game for Switzerland. Enzo Fernandez is going to have to be that other guy for Argentina that puts the ball in the net. And Granit Xhaka, who has a yellow card on him, not that it matters right now, but could matter if he picks up a second one, he's out. He would be the guy that has to control the midfield for Switzerland. This is a tough game for me. I want to root for Switzerland so bad. I think Argentina finds a way to win this one. I'm going to say 2-0. But I think that this is offense versus defense. I think Argentina finds a way to get that first goal. Switzerland has to get out of the shell eventually. They get the second goal. And the Swiss offense is not known to be as powerful as Argentina, and I just think they find a way. Gino, what do you think in this one?
Kev, what do you think first?
Oh, Kev goes first. Sorry.
Very similar thought to you. I think this is a 2-1 game before, you know, they come out of the shell and Messi puts another one away late. They got a 3-1 Argentina, but same type of effect that you have.
I am glad this is the fourth match because I think this is going to be the worst match. I think Argentina blows them out 4-0.
Wow.
Listen, okay. If there's going to be a blowout, this could be it. I mean, any one of these, because Spain can blow out Belgium. You know, France can blow out Morocco.
I don't think Switzerland can keep up with them.
The only one I don't think could be a blowout is England and Norway, because I think that both teams have enough offense to not let it be a blowout. The other three have a potential. I think this is going to be the 2-goal game. Every other game I think I had is a 1-goal game. I'm going to say this one's a 2, and that's it. All right, so that's 45 minutes on the World Cup, Gino. Just the way you wanted it, pal.
All right, let's move to the NBA. Kev, we got some trades going down.
Well, the biggest one I think was probably, or at least the biggest name, was Jaylen Brown getting traded. You know, being involved with the rumors for Giannis. Shocking. They sent him to the Sixers of all teams for Paul George, 2 firsts and 2 seconds.
Yep.
And basically they're giving up Brown's Supermax deal, 183/3 remaining, and takes on George's 110 over the next 2 years. And people say, oh, Jaylen Brown's so good, he puts up great numbers. I think you reach the end of the Tatum-Brown partnership. And Darren, you're going to like this because you've never been the biggest Jaylen Brown guy.
I think he's a turnover waiting to happen in big spots.
The net rating. The Celtics have a better net rating with him off the court each of the last 4 years and six of the last eight. So they play better with him off the court. And I don't think Jaylen Brown is that level where he deserves or should be playing at a Supermax contract. I think the Celtics were trying to get rid of it. And, you know, they took a little bit less, I think, than they could have gotten. But they wanted to make sure they were out of the Jaylen Brown business. This is Jason Tatum's team now. And they'll build around Tatum with a little bit more wiggle room with George on 2 years and less contract or less per year.
Yeah, I mean, on paper, it's not a good trade for Boston because they didn't get a ton unless Philly's first round picks end up, you know, injuries to Embiid and maybe Maxi gets hurt, you know, and the picks are good. But at the same time, I think that Jaylen Brown had become one of those guys that they wanted to get rid of, not just because of contract. I don't think he's a popular guy. I think he thinks he's the smartest guy in the room. I think he's one of those arrogant guys. And I think that Boston decided that they wanted him out. And now he's gone. And Philly will have that. And Philly has done these type of players. You've gotten these type of players before. And with mixed varying success. I mean, I know they asked for Edgecombe and Philly laughed. You know, I mean, that's what it is, because VJ Edgecombe's going to be a star. But Philly on paper right now is going to be very strong. Now it's going to be how do they share the ball. But for Boston, they got out of that contract, and it gives them flexibility going forward.
Any other moves there, Diamond?
It was a huge 16 blockbuster deal. Nobody great in it. I mean, the Wizards get Chris Middleton back, you know, the Bucks get Caris LeVert and 2 second-round picks. Anytime 6 teams are involved, you feel like you have to touch on it. Memphis gets Isaiah Stewart. And Dallas gets Santi Aldama. Detroit gets John Collins plus draft compensation. And the Clippers get multiple future draft picks. You know, so it's a blockbuster 16 deal without a blockbuster player in it. But there we are. Lakers send the very popular, everybody waiting for the potential to come out of DeAndre Ayton over to Washington. Washington gets a starting caliber big man. LA gets, you know, draft compensation back. Donovan Mitchell signs a four-year, $273 million deal. Kevon Looney, who the Knicks were rumored to be in on before the Drummond deal, he signs a one-year deal with the Lakers, as does Quentin Grimes. And just to just recap where the Knicks are, they've done not much, but they haven't. The only guy they've lost is Mitchell Robinson so far, right? They brought back Shamet, brought back Alvarado. They brought in Diawara. I'm sorry, and they brought in Andre Drummond, who you have to feel, in some ways, is an upgrade over Mitch, and in other ways, is a detriment versus Mitch because he's older. He's not as athletic. He's not going to block the shots, but he will rebound. He can hit a foul shot. And he will be able to – the hack of Andre is not going to be the same as hack of Mitch. On the other side of the river, the Nets, they went out and signed Mo Wagner this week. We all remember him from the Michigan days. Two-year, $19 million deal. They already had Keon Ellis. They re-signed De'Ron Sharpe for 2 years, 20, which is probably a little high, but what are you going to do? Josh Minot, they also brought him back. Still waiting for the official trade to go through with Nick Claxton for Julius Randle. But the Nets are going to have a different look. They have a lot of cap space. They have a bunch of first-round picks coming up. Let's see what they do with that. But that's kind of really where we are with the NBA at this point.
All right. Kev, want to touch on Wimbledon before we move on, Glenn?
Yeah, a little bit about Wimbledon. So yet another year where we do not – or another tournament, another Grand Slam where we do not have an American male to talk about. Once out of the bracket, we've got the defending French Open champion Zverev versus wild card entry from Great Britain, Arthur Ferry, 23 years old, ranked number 114 in the world. He's battled his way into the semifinals. Dan, what do you know about Arthur Ferry?
He's born and raised in Wimbledon. The town of Wimbledon. He was born in Paris, but he's been raised in Wimbledon. I didn't know that Wimbledon was really a town. I thought it was just the name of the complex, so I didn't know. But, yeah, this guy's been outstanding. I mean, what more can you say about him? Crushed Flavio Ciboli in the last match in straight sets. After coming back from two sets down in consecutive matches against Zizou Bergs and Gregor Dimitrov, who we all know. He's done everything right. I mean, and he's a local guy. He's English through and through, even though he's born in Paris. And he was raised in Wimbledon. I didn't even know it was a town. But, yeah, Ferry is, I like his chances against Zverev. Not that he's not great, rather than Sinner or Djokovic. So I think this gives him a shot to get to the final. I'm just saying.
I mean, just to put him in perspective here, in the open era since 68, fourth wild card to make a semifinal. Jimmy Connors, 91 U.S. Open. We remember that one.
Absolutely.
Henri Leconte in the 92 French.
I remember that, actually, sadly.
And the 0-1 Wimbledon champion, Goran Ivanišević. He was a wild card entry that year.
I did not know he was a wild card, but what a big server he was.
Yeah. So he's only the fourth wild card to make a Grand Slam semifinal. So that's going to be interesting. The other side, here's a big shock. Sinner versus Djokovic. Djokovic, my goodness, that last match he had, 5 hour, 15-minute five-setter that went to a tiebreak in the fifth set. I mean, 38, 39 years old and still able to play 5 hours or 15 minutes and pull it out.
The guy's still won a machine. 15 of 19 sets in this tournament. He's been really good, really good.
Anything else
on the men? Yeah, but Sinner, his first round match went five sets versus blocks, and he hasn't lost a set since. So, I mean, Sinner's been on a roll since the first match, was that, and then he hasn't been there since. Zverev also has only dropped two sets in the entire tournament. So these have been the guys that have been playing the best. Ferry's obviously the surprise. I didn't know who he was. I had to look him up. First, I thought it was Fry. I thought it was misread. I thought it was a typing error. I didn't even know it. I didn't know who Fry was either. Then I looked it up, Ferry. I'm like, okay, who's it? Born and raised in Wimbledon? What the hell? That's a town. But, this should be exciting. Obviously, gives us a reason to root for Ferry. And, it's hard not to root for the old man playing in tennis, it just is. It's like, guy's still out there doing it, and he does it really well. He's not dominant like he was, but he can still play. And go Joker.
All right.
How about the women, Kev?
On the women's side, we have a chance for the All-Czech final. We've got Liskova from Czech versus Kostyuk, who's the Ukrainian.
Yep. who blasted the IOC today because Russia is allowed to be, and they're no longer independent.
Yep.
They're allowed to be Russian.
Then the other side, the other Czech, Mitrova is playing against the American. Woo! Coco Gauff. You know, all the top seeds. I mean, these are 7, 9, 10, and 12. So the top 8 all went out early. And Coco Gauff is probably the favorite maybe to win this one. And give the American women at least another one.
I think it's 11 straight years with a different winner at Wimbledon for the women. Something like that. It's 9 or 11. It's either one over 10 or one under 10. But, yeah. Every year, that whoever it is, Sabalenka, you know, she was disappointed in her performance. She was the top seed. But, yeah, we get 4 good players. None of these players were considered elite coming into this. So we'll see what happens.
Yep.
And that's Wimbledon.
All right. Kev, you got some hidden gems for us tonight?
Yeah. So a couple of things against both New York teams here.
Outstanding. And there should be, because they all suck.
The Yankees, back-to-back 17K games, hitting-wise, or non-hitting-wise, I guess there's a better way of saying it, non-inning games. First American League team to ever do that. Pitching-wise, Tampa becomes the 4th team ever with back-to-back 17K games. The other 3, surprisingly enough, all in the same year. It was 2016, Cleveland, Houston, and Washington, back-to-back 17K games, all in 1 year.
Wow.
That's pretty cool.
The Mets were part of history last night. Not in a good way. Tyler Tolbert, utility guy for Kansas City. He had hits in his first 5 at-bats, which gave him hits in 12 consecutive at-bats, tied the major league record. Shared with 4 other guys. Johnny Cain in 1902. I remember that well, playing for the Cubbies. The great, immortal Pinky Higgins on the 38 Red Sox. Walt Dropo on the 52 Detroit Tigers, probably the name I recognize the most. And Jose Miranda, the 24 Twins. It was also back-to-back five-hit games also, only done by High Myers of the 1917 Broken Robins and some guy named Roberto Clemente, 1970.
Marginal player. Don't know much about him.
Very marginal. And the other one, just, you know, when you talk about pitching longevity, we'll get to that with Verlander's retirement coming up soon. Just a comparison, Mariano Rivera.
Okay, I have the same one.
And we know he's a reliever. 1,283 career innings, 1,173 strikeouts, 998 hits. Great numbers. Nolan Ryan, 1,271 innings, 12 less. 1,437 strikeouts, that was 260 more, 933 hits, 65 less. That was just after Nolan Ryan turned 40. We will see that.
I actually was going to go with that with one of my treasures, so I got the same one, so I knew it, but that's a great
sorry about
stat.
That.
No problem.
Yep.
No problem.
So go ahead.
Let's talk baseball. Talk baseball. About the Mets, Kev.
Poor Matt Selinger. Matt Selinger, journeyman, 31-year-old, never played in the major leagues. The Mets got him from the Tigers for cash considerations because, you know, the bullpen sucks, because the starters can't pitch more than 4 innings, because we use the entire bullpen in the Atlanta series. He comes in, you know, great story, local kid, Westbury, New York, SUNY Farmingdale. First inning he pitches, gives up 7 runs. Comes back out there, pitches the second inning, doesn't give up anything. His final line of the night, 2 innings, 5 hits, 7 runs, 4 walks, 2 strikeouts, a 31.5 ERA, and DFA today. I don't think we'll ever see him in the major leagues again.
I felt bad for the kid. I really did. He's a local kid.
Yeah. But that was heartbreaking to watch. I mean, but to go back out there for the second inning, I think said a lot about him. This is my one chance. I'll go out there.
He showed some gumption. You know, I like to see it. Christian Scott, nice performance tonight.
Yeah, he went 5.
Well, that's what the Mets do. That's what most teams do. I'm not just saying the Mets.
I mean, he went. I mean, you know, that's why you bring up guys like tonight. You know, he closed it out here. The Mets actually won. They got a big enough lead. Xavier Curry was the next stiff up. Major league career, 4.38 ERA in 150 innings, 100 Ks. Minor league career, 4.69. Why are you bothering with this?
Gino drafted him in the 22nd round of fantasy.
They replaced Guillermo Zuniga, who came up for one inning. Minor league career, 4.63, 1.4 whip. Why are we bothering with these guys? That says something about the way Stearns put this team together. We don't get any links from starters. And I'm going to drop that. I'm going to go – let's talk about not getting links from starters. Yuri Perez, what do you think of him? Seven
How
perfect
do you pull
innings.
Him? How the hell do you pull him?
Third
I just hate the way baseball
injury.
Is played, Gino. I know I'm old. I know you're going to tell me that's how it's played. I can't handle it. You got a perfect game through seven. You yanked the guy? What are you doing? Was it no hit or a perfect game? I don't remember now.
Perfect. Perfect.
Perfect game. Perfect. Right? Perfect game through seven. Let's yank him.
Yeah, let's yank him. 92 pitches. Now that we had a pitch limit of 90 because, you know, it's only his third start back off an injury. It was a leg injury. It wasn't even his arm. Not out there until he gives up a runner, right?
And the funny thing is, the Marlins team is playing really good baseball right now. They're flying up. They're right behind the Phillies. But you know what? The fans deserve it. The fans were booing. The fans were going nuts. They were so pissed that they got pulled. It was a road game.
Yeah. 7-0. I think the Rangers are playing.
Unbelievable.
Shame.
Yeah, it was unbelievable.
Shame. And then the Marlins rightfully almost blew it. 9-8, they held on to win. I think it would have been right if they had lost it.
That was horrible.
Seven perfect innings and being pulled. Rich Hill in 2016, Clayton Kershaw in 2022. The only other two times it's happened.
Because baseball sucks now.
So now we get to Justin Verlander. Told about the other end, the other extreme here. Now today, he's retiring after the season.
He's going to spend a little time with Kate Upton pitching. Not a bad life.
266 career wins. Okay.
Yep.
Second on the list is Scherzer, 222, who probably is going to retire after this year, I would imagine. Can you take a guess who might be 3, 4, and 5 of that active wins list?
3, 4, and 5 on the active wins list is DeGrom up there?
Nope.
Well, he had a lot of great performances and got 8 wins for the year. 3, 4, and 5.
Yeah.
Wow. I don't know. I don't want to waste time. Go ahead.
Gerrit Cole, 156.
Okay.
Chris Sale, 154.
Okay.
Sonny Gray, 135.
Wow.
The fifth most wins active.
Has 135 wins.
It's been 17 years. Randy Johnson, June 4th, 2009, hit 300. Will we ever see a 300-game winner?
It's got to be someone that's beyond special, that's built like a Mack truck.
Yeah.
You know, that just doesn't age. But the way they pitch now, you know, you rely on bullpens for too much. Even if you do really well, you pull them after 6. 3 guys got to come in and do their job for you to get your win. Ah, it's a different sport.
Maybe not.
ESPN put up a thing with Verlander retiring. Active pitchers, and they also included Kershaw because he just retired. Most single-season innings pitched in the last 20 years, Verlander appears 7 times. Scherzer, 4. Kershaw, 4. 5 other guys show up on the list. The highest, yep. Alcantara, and he had 228 innings.
Woohoo! Which is pretty good.
Last guy to do was Logan Webb with 216 and 23. No one goes 200 anymore.
That's actually a lot nowadays.
You see 200 innings, you kind of like bow your head. I mean, you're like, oh my God, this guy really, really gave us a full season this year.
Yeah.
And that's how you wind up pitching Matt Selinger, Zavavian Curry, and Guillermo Zuniga this week. That's how you wind up pitching those guys. Ridiculous.
All right. Darren.
The Yankees suck. They're unwatchable. They don't hit. Listen, here's the problem. The Judge thing has kind of finally caught him. The pitching hasn't been really bad, even though Schlittler had one performance that was Very regrettable. He bounced right back in the next one. They lost the series to Tampa 2 out of 3. But you know it's Armageddon. You know things are falling apart when they lose a home series to the Twins, which they just don't do. And they lost 2 out of 3 to the Twins. And you're saying to yourself, this is about as low as this team has been in a few years. And the reason why is when you don't have Judge in the middle of that lineup and you don't have Stanton sitting there to protect and Goldschmidt is suddenly finally cooled off completely. Now Bellinger has to be the paid guy that goes out there and hits, and he's not doing it. Chisholm's got to be the paid guy that hits, and he's not doing it. They have names, but they don't have guys that are able to make up for the loss of the big bat. For a couple of weeks, it was able to work out, and now the offense is just falling apart. And, again, they're shut out tonight, if the pitching isn't great, they don't have much of a shot to win. Even the game that Schlittler won, it wasn't like they put up a ton of runs. He just went out there and threw out zeros. The sweep by Boston killed me, but losing to Minnesota just means that this team has to regroup, rebound, and get a little bit of offense going in here. I think they really have to look into that Devers trade. I really do. I think they need that other bat in this lineup right now because McMahon is not doing it for you. The Caballero's got to play every day at short. I'll get more into that in a little bit. He's just got to be the shortstop right now. You're not going to do anything with Chisholm. Ben Rice is cooled off, but he's still having a great season. You can't complain about Ben Rice. What was the stat I saw? Austin Wells has 10 RBIs. Stanton, who's been out since April, has 14. That tells you where the catching is at, even though the rumor is Ryan Jeffers will be the guy that they're trying to target when he gets off the IL. Let's see if that's the guy. He can hit, but I don't know. I don't know if he's the answer. G?
I'd also like to see them go back to a more old-fashioned lineup. I think that would serve them well. I'd like to see Caballero 1 and Goldschmidt 2 and Rice 3 and Bellinger 4, or the opposite way, Bellinger 3 and Rice 4, and somebody hitting behind them that has some power. Maybe it's Rosario, maybe it's Grisham, maybe it's whoever you want to put there, Dominguez in the 5. I'd like to see him go to a more traditional, old-fashioned lineup, considering you have no Judge, you have no Stanton for those places, instead of me seeing Goldschmidt hitting in the 1 spot all the time.
I agree. I don't like the new lineups the way they do them. I kind of like the traditional lineups as well. I have no problem with what you just said. I just think they have to get a little bit of an influx of another bat in here because right now this team they're just not producing enough runs right now to win games.
They're not.
It's that simple. Now we're in July. Now it's time to figure out what we're going to do because the team has the pitching staff when everybody's healthy to get them all the way there. But if they don't have enough runs that they can score, they're not going to get there. G?
I mean, would you be upset putting Caballero 1 and letting him steal a base if he gets signed?
No. Absolutely not.
Would you like to touch on Volpe?
Well, I mean, listen. I mean, it's a stat I was going to use later, but I'll do it right now. In the history of baseball, there's only one guy with 1,800 plate appearances with an on-base percentage of .285 and below, and his name is Volpe. I mean, the experiment's 3 years now. It's done. It hasn't happened. And I was a big supporter of the guy. Let the kid play. Let's see what he's got. He don't got it. He needs a change of scenery. He can't do it here. He's got to move on. You're not going to get much for him. I'm not expecting that you will. But the fact is that this kid has to move on because he just doesn't have it here. And unfortunately for the Yankees, they can't afford to have him in the lineup.
Take it for what it's worth, but I was flipping through and I caught the Yankee game, and they put up the starting shortstops.
Yep.
And when Caballero starts, they're 32-18. When Volpe starts, they're 16-20.
It's
also who else is playing, and Judge may be out, and blah, 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 but they're playing much better with Caballero in there.
Well, Caballero's a spark plug on the base paths. And listen, good teams need – guys that kind of get everybody going. And Caballero does a lot of those little things that helps keep people going. They're not scoring right now, so you got to play a little small ball sometimes, especially without your big bat in the lineup. You got to steal a base. You got to do things a little different. I know nobody likes a hit and run anymore, but I still think it's effective when you use it every now and again. I don't know. I just think that this team needs to freshen up. Volpe's got to be out of the lineup now, Gino, in my opinion. I don't know if you disagree. I just think it's done. He's had 1,800 plate appearances. I don't know. I mean, it's not like it's a small sample size anymore.
No, I think it's time for Cashman to realize that the Volpe time is ended now.
Absolutely.
All right.
That's all I got. You got anything else on baseball before I get into some treasures?
No, I need to get into some treasures.
All right. July 3rd, 1966, the great Tony Cloninger, I should say. I'm sorry. Only pitcher to ever hit two grand slams in the same game. It's only happened 13 times total. Braves beat the Giants 17-3 that night. Not a common thing, but two grand slams in the same game. What was the stat I saw? There was only one other pitcher that hit two grand slams in the same season. So it doesn't happen very often, but Cloninger did that in 66. We talked you brought up the Mariano Rivera one. I have a question for you. On July 4th, on the day of July 4th, over the course of history, two pitchers recorded their 3,000 strikeout on the 4th of July. Do you know who those two pitchers were? Nolan Ryan and Phil Negro.
Ryan and Negro. Wow. Talk about two extremely different pitchers.
If you give them two more opposite ways that they pitched, you know, they have it the same way. Since 1920, only two players have gone 3-for-3 over 40 times. Do you know who those two players are? It's not Tony Gwynn. It's not Tony Gwynn. But you have heard of both players.
George Brett.
Well, that's one of them. He got 40.
A
little bit more of an older time player than that, but a superstar nonetheless.
Pete Rose.
Nope. Stan the Man Musial did it 44 times and 40 times for Brett. Those are the only two guys. Those are my buried treasures for this week.
Okay.
You guys have anything else you guys want to touch on?
Nope.
We are the Sports Kings from Queens. Darren, Gino, Kevin. Wonderful, wild, and wacky world of sports. A wacky world with three guys that don't know a thing about the sport. Talked about soccer for 45 minutes. Please download the podcast anywhere you get a podcast, whether it be an Apple product, Spotify, TuneIn, whatever you like. Please share our stuff. We put a lot on social. Like it, share it, join us. If you don't like it, pretend you like it. Share it anyway. And without any further ado, may your sports be with you.